Christianity in its many modern forms is based on the 27 books of the New Testament. But we get conflicting views of Christ's life and teachings from the recently rediscovered ancient Gospels that were excluded from the canon. Bart Ehrman is a scholar of neglected and recently rediscovered ancient Christian writings. He has two recent books. Lost Scriptures is a collection of writings from books that didn't make it into the New Testament. Some of the translations are his own. In the book Lost Christianities, Ehrman explores what these non-canonical writings reveal about the various forms of Christian faith and practice in the 2nd and 3rd centuries. Ehrman chairs the Religious Studies Department at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Terry spoke to him in December.
Many of the non-canonical works that you've collected and written about in your two new books belong to three different schools of thought. Let's talk about what those three different schools are. Let's start with the Ebionites. Who were they?
The Ebionites were Jewish Christians. They were started out as Jews who followed Jewish customs. They were born Jewish, probably followed Jewish customs such as circumcision, observance of the Sabbath, kosher food laws, and such. But these Jews had come to believe that Jesus was the Messiah. They accepted Jesus as the Jewish Messiah sent from the Jewish God to the Jewish people in fulfillment of the Jewish law. And so they understood that to follow Jesus, a person needs to be Jewish. That meant that the Gentiles, the non-Jews converting to the faith, according to the Ebionites, had to become Jewish. The men had to be circumcised, and men and women had to keep kosher and observe Sabbath and such. And so they were a Jewish group within early Christianity.
So they didn't see Christianity as a break from their Jewish faith, just as a new development within it.
Yeah, they saw Christianity as the fulfillment of the expectations of Judaism. They maintained, since this was Jesus was the Jewish Messiah sent from the Jewish God, that obviously this is still a Jewish religion. And so they retained the Old Testament as their scriptures and had other scriptures that did not eventually make it into the canon, but other Gospels, for example, that they said were inspired and authoritative that emphasized the Jewishness of Christianity.
Now, what about the Marcionites?
The Marcionites stand at the other end of the spectrum theologically from the Ebionites. The Marcionites followed a teacher from the 2nd century named Marcion, who was a famous theologian philosopher, who had as his hero the Apostle Paul. Paul had said that a person is made right with God apart from the Jewish law, and Marcion pushed this to an extreme, saying that there's a difference between the law on the one hand and the gospel on the other hand, that the law is given by God in the Old Testament. It's a harsh law that nobody can follow, and so there's a penalty for not following the law, which is death. This harsh, vengeful God of the Old Testament is contrasted with the God of Jesus, who is understood to be loving and merciful, who's come to save people from their sins rather than to condemn them for their sins. Marcion concluded, therefore, that there are in fact two different gods. There's the God of the Old Testament and the God of Jesus and Paul. And so he wasn't a monotheist. He believed in two gods, and he rejected all things Jewish as coming from this other God, the wrathful God of the Old Testament.
Do you think that there's anything from that basic premise that survived into the canon?
Well, the hero of Marcion, of course, is the Apostle Paul, as I said, and Paul's writings form a central component within the New Testament now. Paul has more books attributed to him than any other author of the New Testament. And I think, in fact, that this Marcionite view continues on in some churches unknowingly today, where people continue to talk about there being a difference between the Old Testament God of wrath and the New Testament God of love. That was the original view propounded by Marcion.
One of the groups that some of these writings fall under is the Gnostics. Who are the Gnostics?
Well, the Gnostics are a little bit hard to describe because there are a number of early Christian sects that scholars have lumped together under that term, Gnostic. The term Gnostic comes from a Greek word, gnosis, spelled with a G, G-N-O-S-I-S, gnosis, which means knowledge. These people are called Gnostics because despite the differences among them, they all emphasize that knowledge is the way to salvation. The basic Gnostic system appears to have maintained that this world we live in, this material world, is not the creation of the one true God, but in fact is a cosmic disaster that happened, and that people are trapped spirits. Spirits have been entrapped here in human bodies and need to escape this evil material world. And the way they escape this evil material world is by acquiring the proper knowledge, the gnosis, necessary for salvation. In these Gnostic religions, for many of them, Christ is the one who comes from heaven to reveal this knowledge that can set people free from bondage to their bodies.
Let's talk about some of these early books and what some of their different interpretations are. Let's start with the divinity of Jesus. What do the different sects of Christianity that these books are from say about the divinity of Jesus? Is he the Son of God? Is he divine himself? Is he merely a man?
This is one of the hottest debated points in early Christianity. Today, of course, Christians tend to say that Jesus is both divine and human, both God and man. But in early Christianity, there were wide-ranging debates over who exactly Jesus was. This group called the Ebionites, this group of Jewish Christians, maintained that Jesus was completely human and only human, that he was born to the sexual union of Joseph and Mary, that he was like the rest of us, only he was more righteous. And since he was more righteous than the rest of us, God chose him to be his son and appointed a task to him to be the one who would die for the sins of others. So in that system, Jesus is completely human and not at all divine. Contrast that with the Marcionite Christians, who maintained that Jesus was completely divine. He was he was one who came from the good God to save people from the wrathful God of the Old Testament, and he didn't belong to the God of the Old Testament who created this world. Since he didn't belong to the God who created this world, he couldn't be part of the creation itself, which means, for the Marcionites, he was never born. In fact, the Marcionites maintained that he descended from heaven as a full-grown human in the appearance of human flesh, so that he was, in fact, a phantasm, fully divine and only seeming to be human.
What about the Gnostic texts?
The Gnostics have a particularly interesting understanding of it, because they understand that there's something divine and human about Jesus. And so what they maintain is that Jesus Christ is two things, that Jesus is a man, like other humans, who was born into this world, who was a righteous man. And the Christ is a divine being that comes down from heaven to inhabit the body of Jesus, so that the Christ is different from Jesus. The Christ is a divine being inhabiting Jesus' body during his ministry. That's why he doesn't start doing any miracles until after his baptism for these people, because that's when the divine Christ came into him. And then at the end of his life, since the divine element cannot suffer, since it's divine, Jesus at the end cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Literally, my God, why have you left me behind? It's because the divine element at that point, according to the Gnostics, had left Jesus and returned to its heavenly abode. So for them, Jesus Christ was two things, and there's a separation between the Jesus and the Christ.
How do the early sects of Christianity explain the birth of Jesus? Are there virgin birth stories in the other early sects?
Some of the early sects maintained that that Jesus was born of a virgin, and in what I would call proto-Orthodox circles, in other words, the circles that held to the views that eventually became Orthodox, even in these proto-Orthodox circles, there are traditions about Jesus' miraculous birth that are somewhat different from the traditions we find in the New Testament. There's a very interesting early text called the Proto-Gospel of James, which is allegedly written by Jesus' own brother, James, in which there's an account of of Mary giving birth, and when she gives birth, Joseph, narrating it in the first person, actually sees time stand still. He sees that sheep aren't moving in the field and birds aren't flying through the air, and humans are frozen in space, just as the Son of God is being born. Joseph goes off then to find a midwife in order to assist with the delivery When the midwife arrives, the child's already been miraculously born. The midwife doesn't believe it, however, and decides that she needs to give a physical inspection of Mary, a postpartum physical inspection, to see if, in fact, she really was a virgin. And she gives her a postpartum inspection, and it turns out not to have been a good thing, because then her hand starts burning off in judgment for disbelieving that the virgin has given birth. The infant Jesus, ends up healing her hand, so it all works out well in the end. This has to do with the idea that Mary continued to be a virgin even after Jesus, as is a doctrine, for example, in the Roman Catholic Church, that Mary was a perpetual virgin.
And what about Jesus' death and resurrection? How do the early sects that you were describing describe his death, and do they believe in his resurrection?
Well, it's a really good question. These different groups had different understandings of the death and the resurrection. There were some groups, of course, who said that Jesus' death is what brings about the salvation of the world. That would be the proto-Orthodox view. There were other people who said that Jesus died, but his death had nothing to do with the salvation of the world. For example, the Gospel of Thomas, these 114 sayings of Jesus that appear to be Gnostic in their orientation, they think that the way to have eternal life is by understanding Jesus' secret teachings. His death has no role to play in salvation. There were some Gnostic groups that maintained that when Jesus died, it was just the man Jesus who died, that the Christ had left him to die alone on the cross, so that the divine element didn't suffer at all. There are other Christians who maintain that since Jesus was fully divine and not really human, that he didn't have a flesh and blood body, so that he didn't die at all, that it was just an appearance to deceive the enemies of Jesus, the demons and the devil, but in fact, Jesus himself never actually died.
Were the texts that didn't make it into the canon suppressed?
Yeah, well, once it was decided which books were to be included, there was also a decision that the heretical books had to be destroyed and taken away. That's why we often don't have the original writings of many of these early Christian sects, because they were destroyed on the order of some of the bishops. We do have discussions in early church writings about how to decide which books to include. And the early Christians seem to follow four major criteria for judgment. First, a book had to be ancient if it were going to be included. Secondly, related to the idea of it having to be ancient, a book had to be written by an apostle or a companion of the apostles. Now, some of the books were anonymous, which created problems. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, for example, don't claim to be written by people named Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That's the titles they have, but whoever gave them these titles was trying to say that this is the gospel according to Matthew. What happened is Christians in the early second century started saying these anonymous books actually are connected with apostles. And so they attached names of apostles or companions of the apostles to these anonymous books so they could be accepted, because books had to be not only ancient but also apostolic. The third thing is that books had to have widespread usage throughout the world of Christendom in order to be accepted into the canon. And fourth and finally, books had to be orthodox, meaning they had to agree with the correct understanding of the faith to be included, so that a book like the Gospel of Peter or the Gospel of Thomas ended up being excluded precisely because these books were understood not to represent the orthodox faith.
The group that you describe as proto-orthodox in early Christianity is the group that's closest to what is in the New Testament. Who was this group?
Well, it's a somewhat amorphous group in that we know of some people who belonged, but it's probably a fairly large group with many differences among them. We call them the proto-Orthodox because they represent the points of view that eventually became dominant in early Christianity, that eventually became Orthodox. But these people were living before this victory that they won, and so we call them proto-Orthodox. These are people like Ignatius of Antioch and Clement of Rome and Tertullian, and names that many students of early Christianity would be familiar with, although they're not household names any longer. These are people who insisted on certain theological points of view. They insisted that there's only one God. There's not two or 12 or 30. That Jesus is his son who's both human and divine. He's not just human. He's not just divine. He's both. These are people who developed the idea of the Trinity, that God is in three persons. There's only one God, but this God is manifest in three persons. And they're the Christians who decided how the churches would be run. They insisted that there would be bishops over churches, and eventually that there would be bishops over the bishops, and eventually that there would be one bishop over all, the Bishop of Rome, who eventually then becomes the Pope. So these are the people who insisted on points of view that became dominant in Christianity and that determined the shape of Christianity for the ages to come down to our own day.
How did you become interested in the early non-canonical texts?
Well, when I was in graduate school, two things were happening that sparked my interest. One was I became increasingly interested in the diversity of the New Testament itself. I had started out as an evangelical Christian, thinking that the text of Scripture was completely inspired and without any error. But as I started working on these texts, reading them in the original Greek language, studying them intensely, I started finding wide-ranging differences among these books. And soon I started seeing contradictions in the text, and I started seeing that these different authors had different perspectives, including perspectives that were at odds with each other within the pages of the New Testament. At the same time I was finding that, I became interested in other books not found in the New Testament. I started studying the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Peter, books that are called the Apostolic Fathers, such as the Shepherd of Hermas or the Epistle of Barnabas. And I began to realize that that Christianity outside the canon was even more diverse than Christianity within the canon. And so these two elements of my study are what really sparked the interest that culminated in these two books that I've written.
In your own studies, when you realized that there was such diversity of reporting among the different early texts about Christ, did that become a crisis of faith for you?
Yeah, for me personally, it did lead to a crisis of faith because unlike a lot of my friends who were studying the same material, my friends didn't have the kind of evangelical belief in the inerrancy of the Bible that I had. Their faith was rooted in something else other than a particular doctrine about the Bible. But since my faith had been rooted in evangelical teachings about the Bible, once I started realizing that there were discrepancies in the Bible that I simply couldn't resolve without having to do a lot of very fancy footwork, I decided that the Bible wasn't the inerrant rule of faith and practice that I had assumed, and for me this led to a real crisis, an emotional crisis of faith. But it's interesting that my friends at the time, I happened to be at seminary, Princeton Theological Seminary. My friends at the time learned everything I learned and would agree with most of the things that I think and continue to be solid believers, but it's because their faith wasn't built on some understanding of the inerrancy of the Bible.
Can you speak at all about how you resolved that crisis of faith or how your understanding of Jesus Christ has changed?
Well, I think what I've come to is a realization that that Christianity, above all, is a historical religion that makes historical claims about a historical person, about Jesus of Nazareth. And so it seems to me that whatever a person happens to believe theologically, that Christians are obligated to consider their religion historically, and that historical knowledge can threaten faith, and it may threaten to change a person's faith, but it's not a bad thing because this is a historical religion, and historical knowledge can deepen the understanding of this religion precisely because it's such a historical faith.
Well, Bart Ehrman, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Bart Ehrman speaking with Terry Gross last December. He has two recent books, Lost Christianities and Lost Scriptures. Ehrman chairs the Religious Studies Department at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.